Hello, this is Deborah Klingbeil in Kansasville, Wisconsin, making the audio called Motivation and Treatment, Biblical Style, in May 2011. What we've been doing is I've been touching on Bible stories that help us give a Christian Science treatment, but with this audio, I'm going to begin doing that much more formally. We're going to go through all the steps of a treatment and look at the Bible stories that give us some insight into those steps in the treatment. And then, when that's done, I will be releasing the book, not to everybody, but to the people on this subscription list, which is fairly small. I will be releasing the book on giving a booklet on giving a Christian Science treatment. Before we begin today, I want to make a few comments because I have gotten questions from some of you concerning what's going on in the Middle East and questions about violence and revenge and Osama and all of that sort of thing. So I would just like to make a couple general comments that might help some of the people who have asked me these questions. If you grew up as a Christian Scientist, you will find the whole idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth to be very barbaric. That is not a Christian Science worldview. But when that concept first came out, it was extremely humanitarian because it replaced something called blood feud. Now, blood feud still exists in many, as a system of justice in many parts of the world today. Places where you've seen genocide and so forth, that doesn't only come out of the brutality and depravity that is present in human nature. It comes out of a system of justice. And in blood feud, which also existed in the Hebrew culture before the commandments, we're going back, at least 4,000 years, the idea, it was a tribal thing, the idea was, you're in a fight with somebody, they have a knife or a weapon or a stick or whatever they got, they put out your eye. You can now take revenge against that person, and you can kill them, and you can rape their wife, and you can kill their kids, and burn down their house, and steal their cattle, and then your clan can go to war with their clan, and it can last for years, because you now have a blood feud. When the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth came out, it restricted revenge to what had been done. If somebody cut off your hand, then under the law, their hand could be cut off, but not both hands, and you couldn't kill their kids, and you couldn't go to war for years. And so it was a sense, as perverted as it may seem to a Christian Scientist, it was a sense of equality. It was a sense of justice. You will often hear the word justification, especially if you read Paul's writings. It does not mean, the word that it's being translated from is not like justifying what you did, like defending what you did. When Paul speaks of the justification that comes through Christ Jesus, it's more like the word we use when we talk about when you're on the computer and you're writing and you want to justify your margins. You're going to bring everything into exact right proportion. You know, you're going to make everything fit. And Jesus, although he certainly advanced us from the eye for an eye type of justice, he believed in that proportionality, apparently, because, for example, he told men that they could only ethically divorce their wife for adultery. Now, this had less to do with adultery than it did with equality, because a woman could only divorce a man under the Hebrew law at that time for adultery, but a man could divorce his wife for all kinds of things. So what he was saying was, no, it has to fit. If a woman has only one way to do it, then you only get one way. What she gets, you get. What's good for the goose is good for the gander, basically. So this sense of justification is very important. When we are dealing with people who are coming out of a very different worldview, we need to look not only at where they are on the spiritual path, but where they have come from. And often, what looks to us like ugliness and barbaric revenge, because in Christian Science, we believe that, as Mrs. Eddy says, revenge is inadmissible. You cannot take revenge and be a Christian Scientist. But we also don't believe that evil is a person, place, or thing. And if you come from a worldview where you really believe that evil is a person, then the only way to get rid of evil is to attack that person. But if you don't believe that evil is a person, and you understand that sin existed even before people, and you're going after the evil itself rather than the personality, that's a different worldview. That's our worldview as Christian Scientists. But you know what? It's not the mainstream worldview. And I sometimes think Christian Scientists are very naive, because I know Christian Scientists and good people, you know, who don't grow spiritually. You meet them 50 years later, they're still in the same place. And they have never had to deal with brutality, and they've never had to deal with depravity. They will have to someday. We all have to someday. Mrs. Eddy tells us that we all have to grapple with this belief in a power apart from God. So they don't really know how they would react under those conditions that other people find themselves. But what I started to say was, when you are dealing with someone and you're having trouble because you just find them very violent or barbaric or whatever, don't just look at where they are. Look at where they came from, because they may have moved quite far on the spiritual path, whereas somebody who was kind of born into a different worldview and just sat there for 50 years and not grown spiritually hasn't moved at all. You can try. This is going to be an audio about motivations, and often we can trust people's motives even when we abhor the means by which they accomplish them. Even very so-called evil people are trying to stamp out injustice, or what they perceive as injustice. And that's what we want to do too. Now, our worldview is different. Our method of accomplishing that is different. When you pray, don't ever attack the person. Understand that nobody in the world has a completely correct worldview. Humility is needed here. Go after the evil itself, and go after the system. The system that produces these kind of continual cycles of violence and injustice. Pray for justification. Think of justification as just bringing everything, including yourself, into balance. Whenever you pray, expect to change. We cannot change the world or other people if we don't change ourselves. And you're always going to change, and others too. Everything will come into a better focus. So it would be better to handle the belief of blood feud than it would be to attack a person in your prayers or your thoughts. I hope that makes some sense to you. Okay, when we do watch prayers, we need to think about motivation. The word motive means to move. A prayer is action. Hopefully our prayer will have legs and walk around in the world and do good and manifest. We want to be sure that there's nothing attached to that prayer that could block it or reverse it or change it into an instrument for doing evil. We need to understand also that every single human being has unconscious motivations, things that move them that are not good. The word motive, like I say, means to move. Automotive, when the horseless carriage came out, it moved automatically by itself. It was called automotive. And so in our watch prayers, don't have to take a whole lot of time over it, but if we begin with this understanding that we all have unconscious motivations that we're not aware of and that can block prayer, and it isn't a conscious decision where you can just say, well, I'm not going to have bad motives, I'm not going to resent or be egotistical. You know, that's like saying, I'm going to lose 100 pounds. Well, guess what? You have to do it. You know, I mean, you have to, you know, if you want to be physically fit, pardon me, then you have to actually take those steps. And every time you pray, you're becoming spiritually fit, you're becoming more able to love, you're overcoming all that spiritual flab. But it takes time. You need to be patient with yourself, and this is part of what we're doing. We're entering into a relationship with the Holy. But you've got to go in understanding, you know, that the first time you go running in the morning, you're not going to run 20 miles. And so you want to minimize anything that's in your thought that would block the prayer. Now, you may have unconscious feelings of ego and resentment, and we all do, but that doesn't mean they have to be motivators. They don't have to motivate you. They don't have to have legs. They don't have to walk around, or they can be stifled and put away, put on the shelf, close that door, and the prayer can be perfectly pure. And that's what you want to pray when you're starting. By the way, I apologize for my animals. I usually make these late at night when they're sleeping, but this is the only time I have to do it, so I hope you'll put up with them. You want to pray that this, you want to say in your watch prayer, in your own words, that this prayer is completely free of human will, including your own, that it is only responsive to God's will, that the way is being cleared for God, for divine love to work in this prayer and through this prayer. And you want to ask that any wrong motives be revealed to you so that you can handle them. We have only talked so far when you were getting the printed copy of the standard and you got a few chapters of the book on treatment. We only talked about the watch prayers at the beginning of a treatment. There are also watch prayers at the end of a treatment where you know that this prayer cannot be reversed, that it has accomplished everything that God's will wants it to accomplish, that it cannot hurt anybody, that you're going to learn as much from it as possibly can be learned. And once again, you're going to handle motivations. You know that this prayer has cleansed and healed your motivations and that it has deepened your love for God and so on. Now, we're going to look at two Bible stories today that deal with motivation. The first is in Luke 10, and it is the story of Mary and Martha. And the second is in John 21, and it's the morning meal that we're all so familiar with as Christian Scientists. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were three siblings, and there may have been more in the family, who lived in a family that Jesus was very close to. They lived in the town of Bethany, which was an upper middle class if it was a community today, it would be a gated community. You know, it was a suburb of Jerusalem, so this was a family very involved in the whole temple scene, pretty well-to-do. Jesus loved this family. You know, he will raise Lazarus from the dead. Mary will be at the tomb and see him resurrected. It is to Mary that he's going to say, "I am the resurrection and the life." That's a big, you know, he doesn't say that to everybody. And Martha he loves. I mean, the Bible tells us this, that he loves Martha. Martha's a good person. She has a lot of spirituality. But in this story, and this is before he heals Lazarus, so this is just early on, we're going to see that as good as Martha is, like all of us, she has some bad motives that she's not aware of. And we can learn from that. Jesus comes to dinner at their house. Now, he goes back and forth between kind of the rural redneck area up around Galilee, where he's from, and the richer, more sophisticated, more savvy, political area of Jerusalem. And some of his disciples, like Peter, are kind of the redneck disciples from Galilee, and some, like John, are from the temple area and known to the high priest and all that. They are going to prepare dinner for him because in this culture, dinner isn't just like sending out for pizza. It is a matter of culture and religion. Abraham, when he was still Abram, entertained two men who turned out to be angels. That's where you hear the story of entertaining angels unawares. And because of this, hospitality, giving hospitality to strangers, became an important part of the Hebrew tradition. Also, later, of course, they were in Egypt, and they knew what it was like to be from another country and living in a foreign country and not always treated well. And so, because they had been strangers in a strange land, the Hebrews were to treat other strangers well. Hospitality was very important. It was also a cultural thing. There was no way that you couldn't put on a fancy dinner when the controversial young rabbi that was getting a reputation for himself came to town. And everybody from the temple would want to come and see him, and it would be kind of be a big social event of the year. The other thing you need to know about this story is that it was illegal. Actually, you could be jailed for teaching women theology. It was considered ethically wrong and religiously wrong. Now, there were women's portions of the house and men's portions, and the women's portions had kind of like grids. So, you know, a woman could go into the woman's portion and overhear some of the things, or she could ask her husband later, or her father. But Mary, in this story, apparently is so hungry for the truth that Mary is not a radical young woman. We know her from other stories. She's quiet. Apparently, you know, obeys all the laws of her religion, and so forth. But for some, and Jesus defends her on a couple of occasions when Judas and others go after her. But she doesn't defend herself. She's quiet. But for some reason, she breaks the rules on this big social occasion. Instead of helping her sister, Martha, they would have had servants. They would not have been, you know, directly involved in the dinner, but they would have been preparing this huge social occasion. She goes in and she sits down in the room where the men are and listens. She doesn't talk. So as long as she doesn't talk, it's borderline. But she's sitting at the feet of Jesus. This is borderline. I don't know that he could have really been arrested for it, but it's pretty close. And everybody's going to be watching him. Is he going to kick her out? He does not. He just continues teaching. Martha is feeling very overwhelmed on this occasion, and she comes to him, and she says to Jesus, you know, why? She says, Jesus, tell Mary to come and help me. Now, Martha is right. Humanly, she's right. If we were talking today, we would say she's being a good Christian Scientist. Martha is breaking the rules. Okay, I mean, Mary is breaking the rules. Martha is humanly right. But her motivations are lousy, and the whole story stinks of it. There's never anything wrong with asking for help. A lot of people who think that we're not supposed to be goal-referenced think that that means we can't ask for anything in prayer. That's not true. Goal-referenced is a way of measuring. If you're sick, ask for health. If you need money, ask for help. You know, ask for money, ask for what you need. It's okay. You can ask, but you have to have good motives, and you have to be ready to change. You have to be ready to have God help you in the way God's going to help you, not in the way you want to be helped. But it's okay to ask. There was nothing wrong with Martha going to Jesus and asking for help, for human help. Although we might think that if on such a big occasion she is bothering Jesus with domestic things, that maybe that's not as loving as what you would hope for. I'm glad she feels so familiar with Jesus and so comfortable in his presence that she feels free to go to him. But if your father or your husband or something was, giving a lecture at the university or something, would you go up in the middle and tell him that the stove was needed fixing? You know, this just doesn't feel right. If you look at the story, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but you can read it. It's in Luke 10, and see what you think. It doesn't feel to me like Martha is saying, Master, I love you so much. I want this to be a perfect occasion for you. I want everything to go well. But I'm overwhelmed, and I'm afraid it's not going to go well. I'm not going to serve you well. It doesn't sound like that to me. It sounds to me like she's saying, I'm in the stinking kitchen doing all the work, and Mary's in there, and there's resentment. Do you see it? Do you feel it? Maybe Mary has made her uncomfortable because, by implication, Mary is wrong, and yet Jesus is treating her like she's doing right, and she's feeling like maybe she's not coming up to par. There were many, many ways the dinner thing could have been worked out. I mean, for heaven's sakes, Jesus is the one that made the food multiply in the wilderness. Martha could have just prayed and overcome her feeling of being overwhelmed. She could have gotten extra servants from the neighborhood. So many ways it could have worked out. But Martha's not open to that. She wants it to work out the way she wants it to work out. She wants Mary to come out of that room and come in the kitchen. She doesn't want Mary having that experience. Do you see her motives are not good? She's asking for help, and oddly enough, Mary is helping her through example. We so often want our spiritual teachers, whether it's Jesus or Moses or our Sunday school teacher, our practitioner, Mrs. Eddy, we want them to help us the way we want to be helped. We don't always like the way they act. People say, well, Mrs. Eddy was too tough. You know, they want her to be a more gentle, sweet little old lady. People wanted Jesus to be a political king and kick the Romans out. And of course, Moses, they were always mad at Moses, weren't they? And yet, often the people that we turn to are helping us in a way that we don't realize, through example. So in this story, Jesus, by the way, does not condemn Martha. He commends her. He says, Martha, thou art troubled and careful about many things. And he is grateful for what Martha does, and he values her. But he says, Mary hath chosen the better part, and it will not be taken from her. And in that statement is the help that that Martha needed. If she could have understood that, there was nothing keeping her from going into that room. Dinner would have turned out. Do you see what Jesus is trying to do? This isn't about dinner. This is about the purpose and mission of his life. It's about what's going to be happening thousands of years later with you and me, with whatever is left of Christianity. It's about whether he will be crucified. It's about whether the people from the temple will be able to take in his message and be purified. There are mighty spiritual struggles going on. It's not about dinner. It's not about Martha. It's not about Mary. It's about God. And Jesus is trying to teach her this. So when we pray, we have to understand that sometimes we're like Martha. We're good people. We're holy people. We're doing our best. Jesus, the Christ, commends us. We could still have lousy motives and not know it. And that's why we have to pray for our motivations to come clear. Just there's a place in Psalms where it says, cleanse thou me from secret faults. We are all self-deceived. We are all in the human condition, which means there's going to be a certain amount of ego and depravity and resentment. Often we're not aware of it. You know, handling sin is one of the most difficult parts of prayer. Because sin, and I'm defining it very broadly, blocks spiritual growth and it blocks the treatment from working. And sin is so casual in our society today that we don't realize how much it hurts. It hurts people. But on the other hand, we don't want to make a big deal of it. You know, I've seen people, I knew someone once who was an abusive husband, and he used to be so sorry, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. And then he would do it again. This kind of guilt thing is really an indulgence, and these guilt trips don't heal. They just make you possess the sin more. I think of sin this way. If you're lying on a beach sleeping and you wake up and there's a 10-pound leech on your neck, you're like, oh, you need to just get rid of it. Get away. You know that's not part of you. You don't wake up and think, oh, I'm part leech. You know that it's not part of you. And you just mentally and physically get rid of it. Nobody enjoys being selfish. It is not fun to be egotistical. It's horrible to resent. And yet, we're asleep. We don't know we're doing these things. If you handle sin correctly, it's like waking up and thinking, and you see it. You see, oh my gosh, I've been hating this person. And immediately you think, no, I don't want to be like that. That's not me. I don't want to hate. I don't want to resent. I'm not petty. I'm not... You reject it. If you do it right, you're not like, oh, I'm so sorry. No, that's not healing. When you really see what's in your thought, but you got to wake up and see it, you will cast it out. And that's why Mrs. Eddy says, evil that is seen is two-thirds destroyed. But the kind of half-sleepy, oh, well, everybody does it, it's okay, or I'm so sorry. You know, that's just, that guilt trip thing is not good. So it's really hard to deal with sin. Mrs. Eddy warns that when we're praying, we should not be overwhelmed by the odiousness of our sins. Because as you pray, these ugly things in your thought are going to come to the surface to be destroyed. And you'll get rid of them and it'll feel good. But the process can be kind of icky. And you should be prepared for that in prayer. And I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time on it, but I would say that in your watch prayers, in the beginning and at the end, you want to be, you know, really pray that your motives be good, that the only thing that can motivate you, that can animate you, that can activate you, that can have legs and walk around and manifest in the world is goodness, and nothing else can be attached to it. And when you do that, you might find that at some point in the body of your treatment, certain things will come to the surface, and they might scare you a little, especially if they're other people's sins are bad enough, but your own are just hideous. You're like, oh, how could that be? It's like that leech. You don't want it. But just realize it's a good process, and don't be afraid, and trust God, and put your hand in the hand of divine love, and say, okay, I'm going to walk through this. This is just coming to be destroyed, and I'm so glad it's coming to the surface, and I'm, you know, just hold on and pray for your motives and keep going. Now we're going to look at one more story of motivation, and this is a story that we could spend hours on, so I'm going to just hit it lightly. In Christian Science, we do not commemorate the Last Supper as much as we do the morning meal, which is a time when Jesus appears to his disciples on the shore, and they're fishing. And this is not the first time that Jesus has appeared to them, so remember that. Now, we're going to look at Peter particularly. If you're not familiar with Peter, Mrs. Eddy calls him an impulsive disciple, and he was that. He was very impulsive. Impulsive people do not always think through their actions or their consequences. They don't always realize they hurt people. And because they tend to be impatient, they don't always go back and reconcile and fix what they've broke. So Jesus had his hands full. But Peter also had a boldness and a courage that was lacking in some of the other disciples. He was a man of action. His actions were not always right, but God bless him, he got out there and he acted. Remember when Jesus was walking on the water, the other disciples were just kind of scared. He was like, "Master, let me walk on the water." He went and walked on the water. And then he started to sink because he got scared. But, you know, he tried. During the Transfiguration, when Jesus was talking with Elijah and Moses and people that were dead, the other disciples were just kind of like, oh. But he was like, well, let's build three tabernacles. Now, that wasn't the best idea. But, you know, he had a plan. He was the only one in the Garden of Gethsemane who defended Jesus. And, of course, we know that when he cut off Malchus's ear, Jesus healed it. So it was almost like a rebuke to Peter. But Peter was getting mixed signals because Jesus had asked them, do you have a sword? He wanted to go into that garden armed, and yet he didn't use the arms. So what was going on? I don't think that Jesus knew how it was going to go down, quite frankly. We just think this was all automatic. He just kind of automatically went through this crucifixion thing. Not at all. There were no guarantees. And when Peter betrayed him, that made it harder for Jesus to resurrect. There were consequences to that. And it did hold the world back a little bit. I mean, there are consequences to our actions. We have to take responsibility, but then we don't have to own it. Peter was a good and wonderful person. So to heal it and confront it, but not own it, is such a hard thing. Peter was the rock. That's what it means. He was, in many ways, Jesus' right-hand man. Now, if you look carefully, you will find that the others were just as important, but in much more subtle ways. But Peter was the spokesman. He was the man of action. He was a character. I mean, can you imagine the other disciples? You can see Nathaniel sitting back there making his little comments that he was always making, and Judas counting out the money. And then there's Peter going off like a pistol every hour, you know. You can just see the other disciples like, there goes Peter again, you know. I'm sure that he gave the master a great deal of joy. I mean, he had to be a really fun person at a party. He just was a character. But he had this strength, and he was the one who recognized that Jesus was the Messiah. Not just their friend, not just a guy that was a certain height and had a certain color hair and a very comforting voice and could do all this neat stuff, but the Messiah. You know, he had this power. And Jesus called him Peter, the rock. Peter had pride. Jesus sometimes had to rebuke him very harshly. At one time he called him a devil, and at another time he called him a fool. This wasn't anger, because if you look at the story, there's no anger afterward. It's like when your kid runs after a ball into the street. You better yell at him because a car is coming, okay? When the Last Supper is occurring that night in Gethsemane, Peter, when he hears Jesus talking about how, you know, he's going to be betrayed and the disciples will be scattered, he's indignant. His pride, I mean, he's not going to betray him. And he says, maybe these other guys are going to scatter, but I will go with you to the cross. I'll go with you to the grave. I'll defend you. And he does defend him. He means it. He defends him in the garden. You know, I'm the rock. Maybe these other guys, not me. Do you hear the pride there? And Jesus rebukes that and says, Peter, before the rooster crows, you're going to betray me three times. And then Jesus does what he's always trying to do. He puts it on a higher basis. He tries to make Peter understand that there is this spiritual struggle going on. It's just not about Peter. It's about God. He says, Peter, Satan wants to have you. There is a spiritual struggle going on here. But I have prayed for you, and you're going to be all right. Jesus understands that Peter is going to go through hell in the next 3 days. Jesus is going to go through hell too, but he's thinking about his disciple. He loves his disciple. Jesus is a heck of a good friend. I mean, all the other things, he is the Savior and everything. He's just a good friend. He cares about Peter. He knows Peter's going to go through a hard time now, and he's trying to prepare him. If you really look at the scripture, it seems to me he's Peter, James, and John were all kind of like a little trio within the disciples, but he's been putting Peter with John quite a bit, like when he sends Peter and John to find an upper room to have the Passover meal and all that. He's been pairing them together, just like at the cross, he's going to have John take care of his mom. Jesus knows that Peter's going to need a friend. And when the Master resurrects, there's so many different versions of it, but in every version, Peter's going to be mentioned. In the version where he sees Mary first, he says, go tell the disciples and Peter. He wants Peter to be put out of his unhappiness as quickly as he can. In another version, he sees Peter and John first. In another version, you know, Peter runs ahead when he hears that the tomb is empty. He doesn't just walk to the tomb like the other disciple, like John. He runs. He is Peter. So when we see Peter meeting Jesus at the morning meal, he has already had a chance to talk privately with Jesus and apologize and be forgiven or whatever happened. I don't know. But it's not his first meeting, okay? Now, I want you to understand that the one problem that Peter had is he was very sensitive to people's opinion of him. Maybe it's because he grew up kind of a uneducated, illiterate, redneck kind of guy. I don't know. But you'll see several places in the life of Jesus and later when he and Paul clash where Peter is just sensitive about what people think. And that's what leads him into the betrayal. After the third betrayal, it says that Jesus turned and looked at him. And I can't, you know, different people interpret that differently. I can't imagine that it was a look of anger. It had to be a look of great love. But imagine how Peter felt. It said he went out and wept bitterly. You have to understand that Peter didn't really get the resurrection at this point, even though he'd been told. None of them did. Let's say you had someone you loved dearly, maybe a child, a grown child, and one day you had a fight with them and just, for whatever devilish reason, said mean things to that kid and just were mean to them, and that very afternoon he was murdered and you could never take it back and you could never say you were sorry. And for Peter, he had risked everything. He had risked his money. He had risked his reputation. He believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and to a Jew, the Messiah was someone who was going to kick the Egyptians out and be king. We know that he was a married man. His mother-in-law lived with him. I mean, he took time away from his family. He obviously loved Jesus. He loved what he stood for. And it was all going to end like this? And he was at fault? He did this and he didn't mean it? And it was just a stupid thing that he did and he could never overcome it? It could never be made right? Can you imagine the hell that Peter was in? Now, you also have to think of Jesus in this story, though. Jesus did not take it personally. Had he taken anything personally, he would not have been able to resurrect. And we better learn from that example. Jesus had every reason. The night that he was being murdered and tortured and hurt, his right-hand man turns against him? I mean, you know, wouldn't you, if you were resurrected, come back and say, what the heck? What were you doing? Why did you betray me? What were you doing? What were you thinking? No, Jesus never does anything but love Peter. He really is Peter's friend. And he says, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. So that's setting the stage. Now, in the past, Jesus has been harsh, and he will be harsh in the future. It's right before he ascends. and disappears to human sense that he calls Peter a fool, but he needs to tell him that. But right now, he's on the shore, they're fishing, they realize it's Jesus, they bring the boat. Of course, Peter doesn't wait for the boat. He jumps into the water and swims to shore. The man who walked on the water is now having to just swim and struggle, but that's okay. Despite the fact that he's been in trouble and apparently been forgiven by Jesus and so forth, and maybe it's a little uncomfortable, he still wants with all his heart and soul to be in the presence of the Christ. Do you see what's so beautiful? That enthusiasm, that exuberance, that action. So many Christians and Christian Scientists are just stagnant. There's nothing stagnant about Peter, and that's one of his best qualities. So he comes to shore, and they have this little breakfast on the shore. And now, Jesus is going to probe his motives. And, you know, Peter probably at this point, I'm guessing, is trying to kind of sweep this under the rug. Okay, we got through it, the whole betrayal thing. Okay, now we're going to go forward. But Jesus is not going to let it go yet, but he's going to be very gentle. This is like when your kid runs into the street and gets hit by the car. And he's okay, and he's coming out of danger, but he was in danger, you know. Peter was in great danger, and what he did hurt. It hurt the mission of Jesus. So at that point, you're not going to yell at your kid because your kid is scared, and you need that child to know that he's safe and he's going to be fine and he's going to come out of this experience and he's loved. But at the same time, you really have to be sure he's not going to do it again, right? Because he's in danger. Jesus is going to ask him 3 times, "Do you love me?" That's once for every betrayal. He was betrayed 3 times. He's going to ask 3 times. You might notice also that on the night of the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus asked God 3 times if this cup could not be taken from him, if there wasn't some way the same things could be accomplished without the crucifixion. It took 3 times. He yielded every time, but each time he yielded a little more. And it wasn't until the 3rd time that he was able to yield his human will completely. So we're seeing here that in treatment, it's a process. You're not going to be perfect the 1st time you sit down and pray. You need, and the number 3 is simply symbolic. It doesn't have to be 3 times. But you need, remember, it was on the 3rd day that Jesus resurrected. 3 has some beautiful meanings in the scripture. So he is helping Peter through a process. And we in treatment, we probably don't have a spiritual teacher that loves us enough to rebuke us. We're going to have to rebuke ourselves. And we're going to see now this wonderful way. We're not going to have Jesus say 3 times, "Why did you betray me?" We're going to have him say, "Do you love me?" It's all about relationships. It's all about love. There's a lot going on in the story that I won't comment on. It's a very deep story. For one thing, Jesus is using the word agape, which means spiritual love. Peter is returning the word phileo, which is like Philadelphia, brotherly love. It's not as spiritual. It's not as holy. It's not as high. You know, Peter's having trouble seeing the whole mission of Jesus, in terms of thousands of years into the future. Peter's not quite there yet, and Jesus is trying to raise him up to that. But Peter is really struggling. Now, even though Jesus is being loving, it hurts. It hurts when Jesus asks. The 1st thing that Jesus does, he doesn't call him Peter anymore. He calls him Simon, son of Jonas. Not son of God, son of a person. You know, he's putting him back where he was. He's kind of saying, "Peter, you've regressed back to where you were before I met you." That had to hurt. Peter would notice that. It's not permanent. After this story, there will be no place in the Bible, in Acts or any other place, where Peter, he might be called Simon Peter, but he will never again be addressed without the name of the rock. So this is a temporary thing, but temporarily Jesus is saying, "Simon, you know, you're back to where you were. The son of a mortal instead of the son of God." And then he's saying, "Do you love me?" He's questioning his love and his loyalty. And Peter was his right-hand man. And to suddenly be in a position where that's not a given, where it has to be asked, And it says that he was grieved that he asked him. And he asks him three times. And he says, do you love me more than these? Well, I don't know what these refers to, whether the people around him or the paraphernalia of a material life, I don't know. But remember that he is rebuking Peter's pride, because Peter was the one that said, I'm going to go with you to the grave. I'm going to go, you know, I don't care what these other guys do. I'm the rock. No, now he's having to learn humility. And when he asks him the second time, the story indicates, you know, that there's more than just words here. I'm reading into the story, but sometimes you have to try to imagine it. The look that Jesus gave him after he was betrayed the third time and he heard the rooster crow and he turned and he looked at Peter, that loving look, that was probably very painful for Peter to deal with, and he probably had kind of tried to, you know, suppress that. But now Jesus is probably looking at him like that again. The face of Jesus is looking at him with great love. And he's making Peter think about, what does it mean to love? Am I just someone that you use for healing and to teach and to answer your questions? And just that you're grateful for? Or do you love? Do you love the Christ? Do you love what I stand for? What does that mean to love, Peter? Think about it. Don't take it for granted. And then finally, the third time, it says Peter was so grieved that he kept asking him, kept questioning his loyalty. And Peter says Jesus said, lovest thou me? And Peter says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And in each place, Jesus responds by saying, feed my sheep. Notice this. You don't get out, just because you have some sinful thoughts or whatever, you don't get out of serving God. It's not like, okay, Peter, you betrayed me and that was really serious, so now you're going to be on probation for 5 years and then we'll see. No. Feed my sheep. Like, now. Get out there and feed. You may just have one foot in the sin that you're coming out and the next foot is in ministry. You get out there and you serve. When you pray, you have to be your own rebuker. You need to probe your own motives, unless you have a teacher. But you have to ask, do I love the Christ, and do I love Christian Science? Because Christian Science is not just a personal religion that we believe in. In fact, that's just sort of John the Baptist view of Christian Science that comes to prepare the way. We believe that Christian Science is the second coming of Christ. But what we mean by that, we see mind as the Messiah. That's what Mrs. Eddy teaches. And as the ages progress, we can take in more of that. Rather than seeing one man as the Son of God, we can see all creation. So now we don't just have one horsepower, we have rockets. We have the power of millions and millions and millions of Jesus the Christ in potential. We have not taken that potential. Like Peter, we're still kind of hanging on to, you know, the personal Peter and the personal Jesus. We're not looking at the whole big spiritual battle and the picture and the years to come and healing the whole world. And every single treatment is about that. You're not just healing a patient. You're lightening the burden of the world. You are making a difference. You are bringing justification, maybe just in a small way. You are purifying your motives. You are learning to love. You are entering into a deeper relationship with the holy. But you want to fine-tune that. Be gentle with yourself. You're going to sin. You're going to not have perfection when you start, but every time it's going to get better. It's like becoming fit. You know, if you're a military guy and you're learning to be a special op, the day you walk in, you're not ready to do that, but you're learning. And or if you're a ballerina, you know, you're not going to be able to sail across that stage and make those leaps the first day. But oh, it's wonderful. Every time, every prayer research experiment, every treatment, every time you have a healing or you heal someone, you're entering deeper and deeper into the holy. Lovest thou me? Ask yourself that all during the treatment and during the watch prayers. Do I love a higher sense of Christian Science, or am I holding on to a personal sense? Do I love the Christ, or am I just holding on? Is this about me? Or is it about the Christ truth? Is it about God? Do you love Christian Science? Do you love the bigger sense of it? Or are you just holding on to what you want, your cultural concept of it? You know, the concept that you grew up and you had a church that was like this and you like stand-up lectures and you want this and you want... Or are you seeing science millions of times? If Jesus was the light, we now have that light a million wattage, okay? That's what we're supposed to be demonstrating. That's what we're supposed to be bringing into the world. We are supposed to be able to hold crime in check. We are supposed to be able to deal with injustice and with revenge and heal it and transform it. Not by ignoring it. A lot of Christian Scientists or other people, they just think if they sit there and they harmonize their emotions until they get into their emotional comfort zone, oh, that's a healing. That's not healing. That's denial. So, it's such a beautiful way that Jesus is handling this, looking at relationships. And when you're bothered by something in your thought that you're trying to heal so that you can be a better healer yourself, don't think that because you're a sinner that you can't heal. Everybody's a sinner and you're going to have to, I mean, everybody, we don't believe in original sin, but nobody has ascended, okay? So there's things in your thought that need correcting. It doesn't matter. You still get out there and you still pray and you still heal. Because it isn't you. It's God that heals. You can't heal the sick any more than you can turn that tree blue by looking at it. But divine love can heal. And what you're trying to do is, if you can't, first you control evil in yourself and then you destroy it. But even if you haven't destroyed it yet, just control it. Put it down where it can't touch the treatment. And your sincerity and your love can do that. What do you think, that your little sin is going to stop God from healing? Get yourself out of the way. Don't make it about you. It's not about you. It's not about whether you're a good healer. It's not about what you want to happen. It's not about why you want that person to be healed. This is about God. Be ready to change. Be ready to see other people change. Yield your will. See that patient and yourself as both needing help, both reaching out to God. See yourself and the patient, whether that patient is a tree or a person, see them as completely separate from the currents of human will. Only God's will is occurring in this treatment. This treatment is perfectly pure. It cannot do damage. It is only pure. We are going to learn everything we can from it. It is going to heal everything it touches. You've heard of collateral damage. This treatment is going to have massive collateral blessing. Everything it touches, even in a peripheral way, is going to be blessed. And you are blessed to be part of it. And you don't have to be son of Betty, son of so forth. You are the son of God. You are the daughter of God. And that is what the treatment is about. And all those other beliefs are completely separate from this treatment. You're entering a free zone. And it's a wonderful thing to do. So in conclusion, when you pray, be aware that you may have motives that you're not aware of. Ask that they be revealed. Ask that you be cleansed from secret faults, like it says in the Psalms. Know that any motive that is not good cannot touch the treatment. It just is put away. Doesn't have legs. It can't manifest in the world. The only thing that has legs is God's will, and God's will walk around in the world and do good things, and you reflect it, and it's part of you, and that other stuff is not you, and it's not the patient. Try to remember not to make it about you. Make it about God, and don't make it about the patient. Make it about God. This is all about God. It's about divine love entering into the holy. Don't be afraid if ugly things from your thought come bubbling up. They're just coming up to be destroyed. They're not part of you. You don't have to worry about it. And the Christ is right there handling it, whether harshly or gently, according to need and according to what's best. Know that the Christ is there asking you, "Lovest thou me?" And Christian Science, as a much magnified view of the Christ, is saying, "Do you love me?" And you are answering. And you are saying, "Yes, yes, I love. Yes, I love. I love the patient. I love God. I love myself. I can't be anything but love." Answer yes. And you know what? your treatment will be effective. Okay, so that's about motives. They usually come in at the beginning and the end of a treatment, at the watch prayers. They might sometimes come up in the body of a treatment, but when you read these stories, it makes you humble. And it makes you so grateful that Christ is our friend too. Because sometimes being a healer can be a little lonely. And that's a false sense, but don't let it creep in. Remember that when you pray, you're connected to the good in the entire world. And when you feel affection and love, it does go out and help people. It's not in vain. You hear on the news of people that are hurt, and you just feel a love for them and a compassion. They feel that. They feel that. They feel that touch. That's the touch of the Christ. And even at night, I love that. I love to, if I wake up at night, to just know that that love of God is being reflected by me and going out, and that everybody within the range of thought is feeling the touch of that Christ. It's like physically reaching out and touching someone and expressing love in a different way than you can. You know, prayer is a kind of touch that's different from any other touch in the world because it comes from, its origin is in God. So it's not a physical touch. It's not a human touch. It's a mental touch. It's spiritual. It's from God. And it absolutely fills you with a radiant sense of peace and joy. And it's the best act of friendship that you can have. And it comes to you too. The love reflected by others comes to you. And your love goes to them. And it's such a wonderful thing to know that the Christ is our friend. And we can hear that voice, "Lovest thou me?" And we can say, "Oh, yes. Yes, you know that I love you. You know that I love Christian Science. You know that I love to pray. You know that I love to love." It's our nature to love. That's who we are. Okay, I hope that helps. We'll work on other parts, affirmations, denials, knowing the presence of God, coming into the presence of the Holy. We'll work on that. I have no idea of the schedule. This is kind of the last thing I do. All the other stuff for Prayer Tracker I do first, and then when I'm done, I do this. So whenever I have time to do these audios, I will do them. I hope that they're helpful to you, and I wish you all a very happy spring. Thank you.